In this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Show, the great olive oil hoax, warrior jeans versus worrier jeans, maintaining muscle during endurance exercise, the ultimate guide to napping, and much more.
He's an expert in human performance and nutrition. Voted America's top personal trainer and one of the globe's most influential people in health and fitness. His show provides you with everything you need to optimize physical and mental performance. He is Ben Greenfield.
Power, speed, mobility, balance. Whatever it is for you, that's the natural movement. Get out there. When you look at all the studies done, studies that have shown the greatest efficacy.
All the information you need in one place, right here, right now. On the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast.
Rachel, I feel free as a bird this morning.
Really? Why is that?
Free as a little bird. Because I'm not wearing my pirate patch on my eye. Anymore.
Why on earth were you wearing a pirate patch, Ben?
I had a pirate patch on all day yesterday. And the reason I had a pirate patch on was because something scratched me in the eye. At least I think this is what happened. My wife says I have seasonal allergies, but considering that I woke up this morning feeling fine and dandy, I don't think it's seasonal allergies. I think something scratched me in the eye while I was riding my dorky stand-up elliptical bike around the neighborhood the other night, because I woke up and my eye was swollen and it was watery and red and tearing. And the only way I could function all day long was to put a pirate patch over the eye.
I love that you have a pirate patch just hanging around your house.
It's actually an eye patch. I just call it a pirate patch. It's not marketed as a pirate patch. It's just the eye patch from Walgreens pharmacy. Anyways, though, I actually have a whole video of me wearing the eye patch because Hunter McIntyre and I recorded an episode of my other podcast, the one that's I guess highly offensive, or at least slightly offensive. It's called Obstacle Dominator, and you can listen to and watch Obstacle Dominator 62. What you do is you go to obstacledominator.com, click on 62, and it's actually a very interesting episode. We spent an hour talking about how genetic testing influences like supplement choice, fitness choice, like what kind of workout you're going to do, and kind of looked at Hunter because he's a freak of nature. He's the top-ranked Spartan athlete on the planet, so we went over all his results. But I was wearing the pirate patch and drinking my usual kombucha vodka mix, and it's quite entertaining.
Were you feeling extra piratey?
Well, I do have a pirate joke for you. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
What did the pirate say on his 80th birthday?
What?
I'm 80.
That's a good one, man.
News flashes.
Hear this noise, Rachel?
I can hear it. What is it?
I'm turning the hand crank on my desk because it's not the level I want. I have one of these hand crank desks that goes up and down. I opted to go for this instead of the push button because
extra muscle.
I can get swole. I can get swole while I'm working.
Build
those
guns.
And then I also have this going right now. Listen, do you hear that? A little beep?
Yes.
So I've got this peppermint oil diffuser, and I can put it on intermittent mode where it will diffuse peppermint oil every 10 seconds, then turn off for 10 seconds.
I have had so many questions about your diffuser. We need to put a link in the show notes to
it. We should. We'll put a link in the show notes, or I'll do a story on it soon. Perhaps I've been giving away a lot of things on Snapchat, so maybe I'll give one away on Snapchat.
Brilliant.
A little bottle of essential oil. That's what I'll do. Okay. So if you're listening in, go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/Snapchat. Where in the past 2 days, I've given away blue light blocking glasses, Aztec sea salt, and a whole box of mushroom coffee. I'll give away an essential oil diffuser if you happen to be a Snapchat person. If not, you suck and you're missing out on an essential oil diffuser. But I've got the peppermint oil going on this one, and I'm going to put it on full on mode where it's going to diffuse the whole time we're podcasting, so that I basically have the cognitive power of someone really smart. I can't think of a superhero who has cognitive powers.
It hasn't kicked in yet, then, has it?
No, it hasn't, apparently. We'll wait on that. Anyways, though, so speaking of cognitive powers, though, this is the portion of the show, of course, where we go over news flashes and the latest, greatest things that have come to light in the past week. And one thing a lot of people will swear by for cognitive performance, because it can be used as a replacement for glucose in neural tissue, is this concept of ketones and ketosis. And there was a brand new study in Cell Metabolism that finally reported on the testing done by DARPA, which is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, the research branch of the United States Army. So what happened here was, and this is something I talked briefly about in a podcast episode with Dr. Veach about ketone drinks, but we talked about this $10 million request that the United States Army sent out to DARPA to have DARPA help develop an efficient food that soldiers could take into the battlefield. Mm-hmm. Dr. Veach, when I interviewed him, talked about how he was involved with this research and had developed what is called ketone esters, which are slightly different than what you'd typically find when it comes to like these ketone powders that you can buy on the market and mix into smoothies or a glass of water or whatever. These ketone esters are very expensive, very difficult and time consuming to make, but they have finally been able to test them. And they did it in this new study, and I'll link to the study in the show notes. So if you go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/357. Ultimately, what they found was that when they took highly trained endurance athletes, it allowed them to clock up to an extra 400 meters distance to their workouts by switching their metabolism or their source of cellular energy from glucose to ketones. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting because one of the other things that they found was that consuming the ketone esters caused a very, very low amount of lactic acid, which is a byproduct of glucose utilization by muscle cells, to be present in these athletes. And so not only were they able to exercise at a much higher intensity, but they were also able to be less sore post-workout. So again, these things are very expensive, very hard to get your hands on right now compared to the more popular ketone salts that you can find in the market. But this is the first study.
So what are the differences, really, like the higher level differences between the esters and the salts?
We go into that a bit in the podcast. If folks want to, let's put a link in the show notes, Rachel, because Dr. Veach and I geeked out on this a little bit. Ultimately, here's the story on this. Ketone esters appear to be able to be utilized by the body a little bit more naturally than ketone salts. However, I do not agree with what Dr. Veach said in the podcast, which is that you would have to take copious amounts of salt at a very, very high level that could potentially damage the body to be able to get all the benefits that you could get out of, say, like a ketone ester. Mm-hmm. I think that these ketone salts that are out there that people can use, and we'll talk about them actually a little bit later, because I think we got a question from someone about hunting and hiking and how to maintain energy levels during long periods of time and also maintain muscle. We'll talk about that later on, but ultimately, what this comes down to is if you want like the best of the best, you would have to get your hands on these ketone esters. They're not that available yet, but at the same time, they have finally tested them and they have been shown to be extremely efficacious when it comes to both altering fuel preference in the body and also enhancing, in this case, a 30-minute test. The cyclists in the study were able to cover an extra 400 meters, which is actually very, very significant. That is huge. That's like illegal performance-enhancing drugs and then some.
Wow,
so,
it's exciting stuff.
Yes, we'll link to that in the show notes. And speaking of illegal performance-enhancing drugs, let's talk about the Tour de France, shall we?
Yes, let's talk about it.
So there was a very interesting article on Chris Froome, mm-hmm. who won the Tour de France. And we've talked about Chris before. We've actually talked about him when we discussed nasal breathing. Chris is a guy who wears this thing called a turbine in his nose when he's competing, and it allows him to basically breathe through his nose and more heavily oxygenate the air, because that's something that happens with deep nasal breathing. It's why using, say, like one of these breath right, is that those nasal strips, Rachel? Am I right?
Breath right. I'm not sure. Yeah, I've not heard of them.
They don't have those in Australia?
No, not that I know of.
Just smear Vegemite all
they
over.
They probably
the
do. Someone's going to comment nostrils. And say, Rachel, terrible.
Yeah, so he uses this thing called a turbine, but this particular article that I'll link to was more about his diet because, you know, speaking of ketosis, I thought it was very interesting. He commented, or actually his wife, who they interviewed, I believe it was his wife, yeah, his wife they interviewed, she says, he's got such a sweet tooth, but he's found now that if he does cut back on the carbs, the weight does come down a lot easier than it does in the past. And cutting out foods like breakfast cereals and a lot of the wheat products and bread, but still eating the right food, he is able to not feel hungry during the day. He's still lean, but his muscles look a lot more defined.
So he's not losing muscle.
It goes into how, unlike many cyclists, he's kind of like sworn off starchy carbohydrates, and he's now basically eating primarily organic fruit, organic vegetables, and meat. So he's adopted a little bit more of this kind of like ketotic approach. He stepped up his fat intake. He's doing more eggs. And it's interesting how professional athletes are beginning to kind of tap into this concept as well, including the winner of the Tour de France. Although I'm sure at some point I would let what do you think the prediction to be like in the next year? We'll find out there's some crazy performance enhancing drug. Because
let's so hope always, not.
Inevitably discover about these guys, there's something getting injected into the right butt cheek that we didn't know about, that they weren't able to hunt down until later after the fact. But let's keep our fingers crossed that he's clean.
Yes, let's
and
do
it
that.
Just comes down to either he's sneaking in these ketone esters that we talked about, or maybe it's that, as the article says, goodbye carbs. So it's nice to see some athletes are swearing off carbohydrates, and at least in a high amount from deleterious sources,
right,
you know, like breakfast cereals and things like that. So read that article if you're a cyclist, if you're interested in how athletes are limiting carbohydrates and still succeeding. So speaking of fats, let's continue down this road. My segues are awesome.
Beck, that peppermint oil is kicking in, isn't it?
The olive oil in your kitchen cupboard may be an imposter.
Uh-oh.
And the headline of this article is, most of us are blissfully ignorant about how much rancid olive oil that we use. And what the article goes into is how Congress assigned a job to the FDA to begin sampling imported olive oil to see whether it's adulterated or fraudulently labeled. And the idea here is that there's this long history of scandal in the olive oil world in which, in many cases, low quality olive oil that is rancid has been masquerading and labeled as extra virgin olive oil, when in fact it is not. And in many cases, it's mixed with other vegetable oils and doesn't contain any of the antioxidants or the flavanols or the polyphenols or many of the other things that we tend to find in good olive oil.
We've all become so used to eating the low quality stuff that we can't tell the difference anymore.
Well, if you eat or drink, you can almost chew on a good olive oil, you'll find that it's bitter, that you get a lot of like tannin-like flavors in it, very similar to drinking like a very good herbaceous wine, like a Chianti. And it messes with your taste buds in very cool ways. It's like an explosion of flavor in your mouth. But those flavors include things like bitterness and sourness and things that we're not used to tasting in olive oil. I'm actually a member of an olive oil club in which every quarter, 3 bottles of olive oil get shipped to my house. And when I compare it to what I see at the grocery store, there's little green flakes floating around in it. It's like a little bit, it's definitely non-transparent, but it's cloudy. It's greenish. It's yellow. You pour it into a shot glass. And I do this. I'll pour When the very first bottle comes, I'll pour it into a shot glass and pass it around the table for my wife and kids and me to taste. Very similar, to, again, to wine. And you can pick out all these really interesting flavors. And a big part of this is, for example, polyphenols. They're very, very bitter, but they're very, very good for you, right? This is a big, big part of the antioxidants that you get in olive oil. You get all these tastes that you don't get in an olive oil that you get from the grocery store. And they're stored in these glass bottles that are non-see-through, you know, non-transparent bottles. That's the way olive oil should be. But this article goes into how we have no idea, especially here in the U.S., what olive oil should really taste like.
Yeah, I can see that, definitely.
Yeah.
And I'm curious what is, this is probably a dumb question, but I'm going to ask it. What is so wrong about the olive oil going rancid and us eating it?
That's such a dumb question. basically oxidized fats. So when you oxidize a fat and consume that fat, you know, whether the fat has been oxidized from light exposure or storage problems or anything else, that fat has peroxides formed in it. And those can cause the buildup of free radicals in your body, which can lead to, among other things, DNA damage, to increased risk for cancer, and essentially something that's supposed to be good for you being bad for you when you consume it.
Yeah.
Plus it just tastes like crap versus a good olive oil. Like,
unless you're used to it tasting like crap, then it tastes totally normal.
I think
normal.
Everybody should have a good olive oil and a good sea salt on their counter. And it doesn't have to be the same brand, right? Like I'll use olive oils from Chile, Spain. You know, I'll put a link in the show notes to this olive oil club that I'm a member of in case anybody wants to join this little club where I get the three bottles sent to me. But I'll also have, you know, black Hawaiian lava salt and Himalayan pink salt and Aztec rock salt and different forms of salt, different forms of olive oil around. And geez, I'm not a great cook, but I can make anything taste pretty damn good once I throw in a little bit of olive oil and some good salt. Yeah.
So, I agree.
Yeah. One last little mention of an interesting article for those of you who are planning on having a baby or hang around with babies or get exposed to babies at any given point during the day.
I got lots of babies around me at the moment. I got a new nephew. I got a new nephew-in-law. It's all happening.
I don't even know what a nephew-in-law is.
Well, he's not technically my biological nephew.
I'll do the math later. This article appeared in the New York Times, and it talks about how we can stem obesity and having overweight kids by not only starting before birth, but also taking advantage of some of the things that research has shown recently to act on obesity. There's 23 different genes that are known to increase the risk of a child becoming obese, and many of them are triggered during infancy, during the time that a baby is inside mom, and also shortly after a baby is born. A lot of the article is not rocket science. For example, you know, when a woman consumes a lot of food as she's pregnant and sugar goes up in her bloodstream, that increases the chance that a child might be born with insulin resistance or increased risk of type 2 diabetes or increased risk for being obese or overweight.
So don't eat a lot of food.
Yeah, but there are other things, like for example, things I didn't realize in this article. The father's weight is important. Apparently, being heavy alters DNA in the father's sperm, and that changes gene expression and gets passed down to the next generation. Meaning that if you're a dad and you're not taking care of your body and you're shooting little sperm around here and there, it turns out that sperm is equipped to make fat people more than lean people, which I guess unless you're a Samoan is probably not advantageous for your child's future.
It makes sense though, definitely.
Yeah, yeah. So another interesting one is that a child's preference for highly nutritious foods or like their palate, the development of their palate, the sophistication of their palate is actually influenced by whether or not their mom, when they're getting breastfed, eats a large variety of nutritious foods because many of those slightly bitter compounds, speaking of olive oil or sour compounds, or some of the things that we tend to get exposed to when, say, we're eating like wild plants and vegetables and a wide variety of everything from fish to grass-fed beef to eggs to all these highly nutrient-dense foods, a child will tend to have a higher preference for these more nutritious foods if the mother is eating them while she is breastfeeding.
So she can't eat a lot of food, but she has to eat a lot of different types of food.
Can't eat a lot of sugar spiking food.
Okay.
That's the one that tends to, especially when a child is still in the womb, that you'd want to be very careful with. So interesting article, lots of things to think about. And of course it goes in like antibiotics and, you know, gut health and, you know, all the usuals, but I thought it was interesting. So if you dig babies, especially lean babies, and you want to have more lean, mean babies in the world,
you want to have a fit baby.
Check it out. So we'll link to this as well as all the other news flashes. Just go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/357.
Well, if you're like me, you live a busy life. You don't really have time for many days off. That's why I talk so much about your mitochondria, because they generate about 90% of the energy your body uses. And keeping your mitochondria strong, it's one of the best ways to keep fatigue at bay. But these little mitochondria, darn things, are expensive to run. They use a huge amount of raw materials, especially when it comes to minerals. The problem is most people, including you and me, probably don't get enough minerals. And without minerals, your mitochondria don't have the cofactors they need to make energy. More than 97% of Americans don't get enough potassium. About 80% are deficient in magnesium. 40% are deficient in calcium. And those are three of the big ones. There's close to a dozen other trace minerals that are important for mitochondrial function, and most of us don't get enough of them, and you definitely can't get them from, say, table salt. It turns out that trying to take all the minerals you need by taking single mineral supplements isn't only hard because you need a ton of pills, but it's not the most effective way to get your minerals. That's why I take liquid, humic, and fulvic complexes. These are full-spectrum mineral supplements, which means you get all the essential minerals your body needs in one go without a daily handful of massive amounts of pills or very large capsules or anything else that's hard to swallow. I use Beam mineral supplements because they're almost 100% bioavailable. They come in a liquid form that's easy to drink. It's just two bottles. I keep them in my pantry, throw back a shot a few times a day. They're a great way to refill your mineral stores, especially for those of you out here who are haunting your sauna on a frequent basis, or sweating, or doing hot yoga, or anything else. Keep your mitochondria running strong. So if you want to up your mineral game, give Beam Minerals a try. Go to Beam Minerals, B-E-A-M, minerals.com, and use code BEN at checkout for 20% off your first order. Well, if you're tired of spending hours on cardio with minimal results, then listen up, because I got a game-changing fitness breakthrough for you. The Carol Bike, science-backed, time-saving solution trusted by experts for optimizing health and longevity. They use this special form of a workout called a rehit, which allows you to achieve superior health and fitness benefits compared to regular cardio in 90% less time. That's amazing. That's a lot of time, 90%. Studies show that by doing Carol's 5-minute workout just three times a week, you can improve your fitness by 12%, reduce your risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and even wind back your internal body clock by 10 years. The science is clear. Carol Bike is your ticket to a healthier and more vibrant life. You got to try it to believe it and to see what I'm saying. I mean, it's not like a walk in the park. When you're pushing hard in those intervals, you're pushing, but then it's just like over and it's done and it walks you through it. It's very motivating. It's 5 feet away from me right now. It's right here in my office, my cool little exercise toy in my office. So you get $250 off your Carol Bike. You don't have to wait any longer. You can join over 25,000 riders and visit carolbike.com today. Carolbike.com. I get laughed at, maybe because it's a little bit woo-woo, esoteric, invisible, whatever. But I use quantum energy. I pray over my food when I eat. I try and emanate positive emotions and feelings towards people. I do like little breath work and Tibetan longevity exercise moves to charge up my body with invisible energy. And yes, I even blast my home and my body with certain quantum energy products like necklaces and little boxes that I can use to charge up food. And I get this all from this company called Lila Q. Now, I realize that some quantum energy stuff is not provable by science, but Lila does have third-party studies revealing a remarkable 20 to 30% increase in ATP production, a vital process for cells. Quantum energy has over 59 studies already done and counting. These are randomized double-blind studies these folks are doing for blood quality and HRV optimization. I can't explain it, okay? I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I can explain how quantum energy would increase blood energy or blood quality. Could be placebo. I don't know. But all I can tell you is I wear their necklace. I use their products. I blast my home with their energy. And it's called Lila Q. I've got a podcast with them, a few, if you want to take a deeper dive. But you just go to the website. Check it out. It's kind of fun to surf around. And you know what? If anything, you're going to have some cool-looking conversation products at your house and hanging around your neck. I love them. Lila Q, LEELAQ.com. Use code BEN10 for 10% off. LeelaQ.com. Use code BEN10 for 10% off.
Listener Q&A.
Hey, Ben, it's Grant. I saw a Snapchat story from you the other day, and it pertained to napping and your daily schedule of that. I saw that you said naturally you wake up about 20 to 40 minute naps almost daily, and it's part of your ritual. And I had I was curious as to how your body naturally goes 20 to 40 minutes and wakes up by itself without an alarm, and what it would mean if you go longer, say like 2 hours or 4 hour naps, 3 hours. And what that means, if something's wrong with your body or what that pertains to. So thanks. Love the podcast. Love following you on social media and keep up all the great content.
Rachel, do you nap?
I haven't mastered the art of napping yet. I nap, I fall asleep for 2 hours and then I ruin my sleep for the next night. So tell me what I can do.
But when you nap for 2 hours?
Yes. Isn't that terrible? I just can't. I have to set an alarm to wake up, but then often I'll sleep through that alarm. So
interesting. Well, we'll get into why it is that when you nap, depending on the timing of the nap and your sleep the night before, that you would fall asleep for 2 hours when you nap. And by the way, actually, that reminds me, yesterday I did take a 2 hour nap because my eye was bothering me so much. In the middle of the day, I took CBD, I took cannabidiol. You know, the nature CBD that our company makes.
Yeah, I love it.
I took six of those.
So six?
60 milligrams of cannabidiol, which is blended with
don't try this at home, kids.
Yeah, with lunch I did this. Ashwagandha and lemon balm and magnesium, took it and just crashed for 2 hours. And of course, I always pay the price later on when I'm working late into the night because I slept for 2 hours in the afternoon. But cannabidiol, if you do need to knock yourself out with a nap, will do the trick. So anyways, napping, it's really interesting. And if you listen in for the next little bit, you're going to know everything you need to know about how to take smart naps and why you should consider taking them. So they've actually done electroencephalography measurements of people's brains and their brain waves and their brain activity when they nap versus when they do not nap. And they have found that a midday siesta, a midday nap, when timed properly, and I'll tell you how to time that properly briefly, actually results in significantly increased EEG and brain activity, better than exercise, better than caffeine when you take that nap. So you almost get an extra day. You know, it's like a smart drug in a way. Tony Robbins, and I'm seeing Tony Robbins advertisements all over the place for his new documentary.
I've heard it's brilliant.
Yeah. I need to see it at some point. But he says not to nap. He says resist the nap urge by doing, I believe it's push-ups is the thing that he recommends. And you certainly do get an increase in blood circulation. You get an increased level of what are called catecholamines when you do, for example, exercise or, you know, slapping yourself in the face or caffeine or anything else as a replacement for a nap. But you don't get this increase in alpha brainwave activity and EEG activity compared to what you get with the true neural boost of a nap. So there's something to be said for napping. And when it comes to why that is, I think it's quite fascinating to kind of think about the reasons that we might nap. So for example, if you look at a lot of other animals, they have developed almost like a siesta habit in the mid-afternoon, and it's to get around the midday heat. Like people who hunt know that the worst time to be hunting, unless you're doing some spot and stalk and trying to catch an animal sleeping, which is actually how I shot my last deer, was I was out in the middle of the afternoon and caught it while it was resting.
Poor deer, I can't help it.
I know what people are thinking. No, Ben shot a sleeping deer. No, it's more like this. You can see the antlers. This was an axis deer. So I caught the antlers from 30 yards, and then you just sit there waiting for the animal to move. You if you try to sneak up on it, you'll wake it up. An animal will sense you and run. But if you simply wait, it'll eventually stir, and then you can take your shot and try to take it down. So anyways, though, we Digress. The idea here is that many animals have developed a siesta habit as a way of getting around the midday heat. And we may have, as humans, have a little bit of this evolutionary or ancestral built-in mechanism for that. There are also, when we look at a lot of newborn babies, as well as a lot of animals, we see them sleep at many times during the day. And this appears to be somewhat advantageous for optimizing what are called memory circuits, meaning you can get enhanced short-term and long-term memory by engaging in some form of a sleep cycle at some point during the day. Obviously, you get a huge amount of that at night, but you almost put a little bit of icing on the cake or a cherry on the cupcake or however you want, whatever dessert analogy you want to use to describe it, dessert metaphor. But the idea is that you increase the supply of neurotransmitters and the size of networks that are responsible for increasing your short and long-term memory when you can get a nap in during the day. And we've talked about this on previous podcasts. Many animals do not get as deep a sleep as humans do when they sleep at night. So you'll see animals like dogs are a perfect example, right? Lounging around during the day, taking multiple what would be called polyphasic sleep cycles during the day, nap cycles, you know, put in at various points throughout the day. Humans don't need that much to increase our memory or to increase neuronal repair because we sleep so well during the night. But it appears that we do get a big memory boost and a big increase in that, again, that EEG brain activity by napping at some point during the day. So
when is the best time to nap and how long should we nap for?
All right, so I will get into that in just a second. I'm going to give you some rules for napping 101. But there are, in case you're still on the fence about napping, there are a few cons and a few pros, I would say, to napping. Now, when we get into the first pros, this is simply the cool people analogy. You look at some very successful people. Winston Churchill, he would actually do a 2 to 3 hour nap in the afternoons. Bill Clinton was a napper. Napoleon was a napper. John F. Kennedy was a napper. Thomas Edison was a napper. Albert Einstein was a napper. You get many successful, especially like politicians and world changers, they seem to have this habit of locking themselves away at some point in the afternoon to nap. I personally have the same habit around 1 to 2 p.m. in the afternoon, and I'll explain why I choose that time. I simply disappear, and anybody who's in my house knows that they're not going to see me for anywhere from 20 to 60 minutes. And I go and I put in these binaural beats. I use an app called Sleep Stream, and it plays binaural beats in each ear, and I put it in what's called power nap mode, and it lulls my body into sleep. And you can even put it into a mode where it will take you from stress. It's called a stress to power nap mode, where it will take you from very stressful binaural beats and pull you from these beta stressful brainwaves down into your alpha brainwaves and then into delta brainwaves as you engage in that nap. So first of all, cool people nap. That's number one.
If that's not reason enough,
you know that you get the significant increase in brainwave and alertness. And this is especially useful if you have a creative profession in which you need to be creative in the afternoon or the early evening. Because I do a fair amount of writing in the evenings, I found that it helps tremendously when I need to write or when I need to play music, such as work on my ukulele tunes in the evening. So, as I mentioned, also napping has been shown to increase what's called memory consolidation, especially when you nap, and that nap takes place in the second half of the day. It's been shown to help combat sleep deprivation. So we know that sleep deprivation can do things like decrease insulin sensitivity. We know that it can increase the production of hunger hormones like ghrelin while decreasing the production of appetite regulating hormones like leptin. Sleep deprivation can also vastly decrease your growth hormone production, which is essential for, you know, things like muscle gain and fat loss. And you actually see less of a deleterious hormonal effect in nappers. Even when those nappers are sleep deprived, right? Even if they're sleeping 3 to 4 hours a night, you can reverse a lot of the hormonal issues associated with sleep deprivation when you nap. Mm-hmm. And then they've also, in a couple of studies, shown that napping can reduce blood pressure and can also increase cardiovascular health. So
that's quite a list.
Yes. But if you don't time your nap properly, it can, as you've alluded to, Rachel, can cause insomnia. So proper timing mitigates this problem, but napping can cause insomnia if you have a poorly timed nap. It can also result in what's called sleep inertia. What this means is that we have sleep drive built into our day where we get sleepier and sleepier as it gets closer to the evening. And that's part of our natural, normal circadian rhythm. A poorly timed nap will shift that sleep inertia forward, which is why yesterday I wasn't tired until about 10:30 or 11 p.m. I shifted my circadian rhythm forward. And if I'm not careful, a circadian rhythm that gets shifted forward can stick with you, right? You can get to that point where you're one of those people who's just like, oh, I can't go get to sleep until midnight. That can, among a ton of other issues, you know, artificial light in the bedroom, not getting exposure to a lot of natural light in the morning, etc. Poorly timed naps can also cause that. So anyways, how do you properly time a nap?
Yes, tell us.
The very first thing is that you need to measure the optimum length of the period between when you naturally awake and your nap to maximize the effectiveness of a nap. So here is the key. A nap should occur approximately 7 to 8 hours after you naturally wake.
So you say naturally wake, which means not waking up to an alarm.
I don't recommend people wake up to an alarm anyways. I recommend that people either use these phone apps that you set to say, I want to wake at some point between 6 and 7 a.m. The phone app detects when you're in your lightest stage of sleep between 6 and 7 a.m. Let's say that occurs at 6:19 a.m. and it wakes you gently at 6:19 a.m. An even better approach would be to pair that with natural light in the bedroom. I believe Withings, and I will hunt this down and link to it in the show notes for you listening in. I believe it's the Withings Aura, if I remember properly. It is a sleep sensor that produces light to wake you. Mm-hmm. And what that means is it doesn't wake you with like a blaring alarm clock or, you know, rock music or something like that. It's just basically a very, very therapeutic or therapeutic isn't the right word. It's a very
gentle.
Thank you, Rachel, for supplying me with your Australian vernacular. Gentle way to wake up. So basically the Withings Aura would be a perfect example of this. A sunrise alarm clock would be another example. But
so I used a sunrise alarm clock and so you can set it to sunrise and then the sun goes to level 10 at its fullest, but then the alarm eventually goes off if you don't wake up. And I found that I never actually woke up to the sunrise part and always only woke up to the alarm.
Mm, yeah. So were you wearing a sleep mask or anything like that?
No, it's just the light didn't seem bright enough to wake me up.
You know, I would be interested to see your sleep cycle, see how much deep sleep you're getting. I don't know if you've ever tracked your sleep, but you may you may have some issues that are occurring during the night of sleep that are causing you to have what's called oversleeping syndrome or need for more sleep. I actually just wrote an article on this. It hasn't been published yet. It's going to appear over at quickanddirtytips.com. But it is about how one of the number one causes of a need to sleep, no matter how much you sleep, is sleep apnea.
Interesting.
Yeah, which can be fixed very, very simply. We have a few podcasts on it, but it can be fixed with a mouth device that adjusts your jaw while you sleep. I would consider, if I were you, though, looking into whether or not you have sleep apnea. Because if you have it, it can make you want to sleep more, sleep through alarms, feel groggy even if you're getting 9 hours of sleep, etc. So sleep apnea is something to look into.
Good. All right. But so 7 to 8 hours after waking up naturally is the great time for a nap.
Exactly. That's a perfect time for a nap. So if you're a 6 a.m. wake time person, a perfect nap time for you would be 6 a.m. plus 7 hours to 8 hours, which would be you settle down for a nap between 1 p.m. and 2 p.m. Okay. So
yes.
Once you exceed 8 hours, that's where you start to shift your circadian rhythm forward, get more deleterious effects, etc. The next thing is that a well-scheduled nap, contrary to popular belief, will not cause drowsiness later on in the day, even if that nap is long, right? You can take a 60 to 90 minute nap. It's not going to disrupt your circadian rhythm. It's not going to cause extreme grogginess the rest of the day unless it's a poorly timed nap. So as long as you're napping 7 to 8 hours from the time that you wake up, then you'll be fine in terms of that nap, no matter how long it is, not messing up your sleep inertia.
So 60 to 90 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Now, some people will go through sleep cycles. So a sleep cycle would be like going from your phase one sleep down to your phase four sleep and back out. So the recommendation is that you get in any given week about 35 of those sleep cycles. Let's say that you're sleeping 7 hours a night. Many people will go through four sleep cycles during the night. Some people will go through five. If you're going through four, it would definitely behoove you to get your fifth by taking a slightly longer nap in the afternoon. If you're getting five just fine during the night, five sleep cycles during the night, then for you, you might just need a 10 to 20 minute power nap. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So the next thing is you need to preferably time your least stressful activities to occur in that last hour before the nap, which is why you shouldn't work hard during lunch. I actually like to do lighter activities during lunch, maybe my Facebooking or, reading some Snapchat messages or, thumbing through a magazine that has come in the mail, something that doesn't involve heavy and hard stressful activities for that hour before the nap. You will have a better nap if you can do that. And so if you can program your day so that lunch is not stressful and lunch doesn't involve a lot of heavy business meetings, that's best.
What about what we eat at lunch for the best nap?
In terms of what you eat, that's going to be dependent on genetics. It's going to be dependent on food tolerances, et cetera. I've found that extremely heavy meals cause me to become very groggy and almost as though a nap becomes a requirement more than an option. I eat pretty light lunches, right? I do things like miracle noodles, which are a form of pasta, but they're made from shirataki. So it's zero calories and zero gluten. And so it's just insoluble fiber. And I'll, for example, put those in a cast iron skillet with some tomato and some fennel seed and a handful of olives and maybe about half of an avocado, some sea salt, some pepper, and I'll just basically grill all that up very quickly and dump that into a bowl and eat it with a fork. Mm-hmm. Or I'll have just a bed of vegetables and sometimes I'll put some sardines or some seeds or some nuts on there. But I don't do big sandwiches or heavy soups or giant smoothies and things like that for lunch. Lunch is pretty light for me. So
if you were to eat a heavy meal and that was to make you require a nap, if you wanted to nap every day, would that be a bad thing? Basically, can food help you nap?
The only thing I'd bear in mind is that if lunch is going to be a very calorically dense meal, that especially if staying lean is a priority for you, that you realize you may need to go for a lighter breakfast
or dinner
if you've decided mm-hmm. lunch is going to be the big meal.
Yeah,
exactly. And a meal before a nap is recommended. It can help a little bit. I just don't like that meal to be super heavy. I also don't like to wake up, burping up my meal because I feel like digestion shuts down a little bit when one sleeps, which is true once you lie down. So I'm careful. I'm not super duper heavy. Tiniest amounts of caffeine in your system can interfere with the quality of that nap. So you do want to be careful. Remember, caffeine has a half-life of, depending on the person, whether you're a fast caffeine oxidizer versus a slow caffeine oxidizer, which you can determine via genetic testing. Coffee can stick in your bloodstream for 3 to 6 hours, which means that if you're planning on taking a nap around 1 or 2, you may need to have that morning cup of coffee all kind of done and dusted between, 8 and 9 a.m. at the latest. Mm-hmm. So if you really want a good nap, especially if you are a slow caffeine metabolizer, not a fast caffeine metabolizer, which again, you can test with genetics, consider not drinking like mid-morning caffeinated beverages or late morning caffeinated beverages or iced tea with lunch or things along those lines. So. So those are the main recommendations as far as napping goes. With the biggest one, probably the biggest tip I can give folks is get that nap in about 7 to 8 hours after you've woken. And what I'll do is I'm writing a note to myself. I'll link in the show notes to that SleepStream app that has the power nap function that I mentioned. And, I do a few other little things when I settle down for a nap in the afternoon. Like I will, I'll use a little bit of a lavender, for example, lavender essential oil on the upper lip to help with relaxation. And I do nap with a sleep mask as well.
I'm also curious how devices like the SR1 impact napping. Does that sort of have any effect?
That's a good question.
If you use the SR1 the night before or something?
For people who are listening, and the SR1 is a sleep device that emits what's called a pulsed electromagnetic field. I actually put it on my body. You're supposed to wear it on your collarbone because that's close to what's called your brachial plexus, which sends a signal to your brain to produce more delta brainwaves. It induces a very, very deep sleep. Some people find that they do wake groggy when they use that for a nap. Some people find that if they can't nap, though, that actually allows them to nap quite well. So, I don't use it for a couple of reasons. First, I find that I can nap just fine without it. Second, I use it all night long. And part of me wants to not become dependent on it for napping. Yeah. And so I just don't. You know, if I'm on a plane, for example, I don't want to take a nap on a plane. I'll use it on a plane just because it's small and portable. And frankly, anything I can do to get to sleep faster on a plane, I'll do, aside from Valium and copious amounts of alcohol, which will cause you to, by the way, because I've tried this, go to sleep in San Francisco and wake up in Hong Kong pretty easily. Valium and red wine is a very potent combo.
It's like time travel.
You're going to feel like $1 million afterwards, but it can work. Yeah, it's like time travel. So anyways, coming full circle, Grant basically says that I say I naturally wake after a 20 to 30 minute daily nap, and it's part of my ritual. And he's curious how my body naturally goes 20 to 40 minutes and wakes up by itself without an alarm, and what it means if I nap longer, like 2 to 4 hours. Basically, I answered a lot of Grant's questions in my explanation there, but ultimately, the body will wake naturally when it is ready, when it has consolidated the memories, when the brain has gotten the neural rest that it needs for the day. And if I have slept 7 to 8 hours the night before, for me, that magic spot is 20 to 40 minutes. That magic time frame is 20 to 40 minutes. If you nap longer, it can indicate, like I mentioned to Rachel, that you have an underlying sleep condition like sleep apnea, for example, that is keeping you from getting enough high quality rest the night before. If you nap longer, it could mean that you're having too heavy of a lunch. If you nap longer, it could mean you have an extremely cognitively stressful morning. And finally, it could just mean that you popped way too many cannabidiol capsules and knocked yourself out into a coma. So it could be multifactorial, but ultimately, that is the skinny on napping.
One quick last question. If I was to sleep track, would you recommend I use the Aura?
The Aura ring for sleep tracking?
Yes, the Aura ring.
That's good for looking at your sleep cycles, but if you want to specifically see if you have sleep apnea and you don't want to order like professional sleep monitoring equipment that you stick up your nose and all over your head while you're asleep, best bet for you would just be a pulse oximeter. You can get a pulse oximeter that will monitor whether or not your oxygen is falling at different times during the night. So you can buy a pulse oximeter, and I will put a link in the show notes to the brands that will actually monitor your what's called your blood oxygenation levels all through the night. And what you'd want is to wake up in the morning and see if there are specific periods during the night where your pulse ox starts to go from 98 and all of a sudden it's down at 95 and 93 and 90. And if you see that that's the case, it's highly likely that you have sleep apnea and highly likely that you should consider going to a sleep professional to actually get a dental fitting for a mouth device that reduces the obstructive apnea while you're asleep. So,
okay. Awesome. Thank you.
Yes. And they're quite attractive at parties too.
I was going to say.
Yeah.
Hi, Ben. Dallas here from Australia. Love your podcast. After your recent podcast with Dr. Chopra, I have a question about coffee when breastfeeding. The study showed that coffee consumption had little impact on the child when pregnant. Is this still the case when breastfeeding? I have a 4.5-month-old daughter and want to know if I can safely drink caffeinated coffee when breastfeeding without affecting her. We only drink good quality, mold-free coffee. Thank you, Dallas.
Well, I was really excited to listen to that podcast with Dr. Chopra because I love the idea of drinking 65 cups of coffee a day. It was too. So validating.
Yeah. I think one's small intestines would probably wear away and just drop out your butt if you did actually drink 65 cups of actual coffee per day. I'm guessing that this Voltaire guy that we talked about in that podcast episode was perhaps sipping a half a shot of espresso or something like that. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to pregnancy, we do know that caffeine can cross the placenta from the maternal to the fetal bloodstream, and that the fetus only has a very slow ability to be able to metabolize or break down caffeine. The interesting thing is that when you're pregnant, maternal metabolism of caffeine also slows down during pregnancy. So that means caffeine lingers in mom's bloodstream for a longer period of time. So we know that when you consume caffeine during pregnancy, that it enters fetal circulation. The problem is that there's almost like a myth out there that this will cause, for example, birth defects or miscarriages. And I think that we need to look into the research on both this and breastfeeding to really decide whether a mom can get away with drinking coffee.
So what does the research say?
Well, there was one big review of caffeine safety in pregnancy that they did in 2013. And this was like a big cohort study. And what they found was that when we look at miscarriages, there's really not a big link. Assuming that you're under 200 milligrams of caffeine per day, and a cup of coffee, average cup of coffee is 100 milligrams per day, that there's really not a big risk for or incident of miscarriage when you are drinking coffee moderately. Okay, so 1 to 2 cups a day of just a basic black coffee. All right, not Red Bull, not Monster Energy drinks, not no-dose pills, but just a cup of coffee. Now, you tend to see a few confounding variables, though. For example, studies have shown that women who consume more caffeine while they're pregnant also tend to be more likely to be smokers. They tend to drink alcohol while in pregnancy. They tend to be older. And so all of those factors could increase miscarriage risks. So you need to make sure that you pay attention to some of these studies and see whether or not they're actually taking into account the lifestyle of the type of mom who tends to drink caffeine and coffee and, you know, snort crack and hang out with hookers all, you know, the whole time she's pregnant. So that's one thing.
So what about the risk of having just a caffeine jacked up baby instead of miscarrying?
So to answer your question about the effects of caffeine on the actual child, there have been some studies that have looked at the baby's behavior under the influence of caffeine. So there was one study where they looked at heart rate and sleep times and found that even though the infants absorbed caffeine, just like I just described, and in this case, is the moms were drinking up to 5 cups of coffee per day while breastfeeding, they didn't notice any difference in the baby's heart rate or in the baby's sleep times. In another study that they did, and this was in 2012 in the Journal of Pediatrics, they also compared maternal caffeine consumption in breastfeeding moms to moms that didn't breastfeed with caffeine in their systems and found no significant differences in the sleep patterns of the babies.
So is it just that caffeine is not affecting the baby?
It doesn't appear to be affecting them when it comes to increased heart rate or, you know, trouble feeding or, you know, slower, you know, ability to gain weight because of some big bump up in metabolism or anything like that. Although there was one study in which they looked at babies that were dosed with caffeine to treat, speak of the devil, apnea, because some babies, especially premature babies, get sleep apnea. And that's again that complete drop in breath pattern while asleep that causes a big drop of oxygen levels while asleep. And what they found was that when the breastfed baby is absorbing a high amount of caffeine because mom is drinking a lot of coffee, and in this case we're talking about 10 to 20 times the amount of caffeine that we would see in these other studies, they actually did show an increased heart rate in the babies. They did show a little bit of trouble feeding. They did show slower weight gain. It did reduce apnea as well in these kids, but this was with copious amounts of caffeine. I mean, we're talking about, like, you know, that Voltaire-esque, you know, this would be like 10 plus cups of coffee a day. In most cases, when we look at all these different studies on caffeine and breastfeeding, in the case of pregnancy, staying under 200 milligrams per day appears to have no deleterious effect on birth weight, miscarriages, etc. And for breastfeeding, staying under 300 milligrams per day appears to be just fine. And once your child is 5 to 6 months old, it appears to be a non-issue, period. So ultimately, I think
babies are resilient.
Babies are resilient, and we've been completely lied to by, I don't know who would have lied to us about caffeine. Who would have profited from lying to us about coffee and caffeine? Who's the scapegoat?
Somebody who doesn't sell coffee or caffeine.
The but baby wants food us industry.
The baby food industry.
Gerber's trying to get us to feed our babies pea mash and sweet potato puree.
When all they need is a cup of coffee.
All they need is a good frappuccino, baby.
Hello, Ben. This is Alex. I love the podcast and I have been listening for many years now. My question regards hiking. I'm going to Norway for a hiking trip and I was thinking, how would I keep myself healthy without losing too much muscle during the trip with the least amount of weight to carry? And would that change if I were to hike, for example, a 2,000-mile Appalachian Trail instead of a week-long hike? Thank you.
So Alexei wants to have his cake and eat it too. He wants to go on these big, long hiking trips but stay completely swole.
Yeah, I guess that's having his cake and eating it too, isn't it?
Well, everybody wants to finish their hiking trip and be able to flex off, right? Fit into their Welcome to the Gun Show shirt.
Right, yes. I'm assuming that's what's happening.
Yeah, so maintaining... So what this comes down to for me, like when I think about this, is for anybody. Let's say you're not a week-long hiker. Let's say you're not necessarily, you know, completing the Appalachian Trail, but you are an endurance exerciser. Or let's just say you have a high-calorie burn in general due to your lifestyle. I don't know, maybe you're a roofer or a construction worker. Or who else burns a lot of calories during the day? A nurse?
Personal trainer?
Surgeon, personal trainer.
Ooh, a surgeon.
Yeah. But you don't want to necessarily eat copious amounts of calories, carry copious amounts of calories, carry heavy amounts of food. As you know, as Alexei noted, you know, when you hike, you want to stay relatively lightweight. And I suppose ribeye steaks are probably not the best fit for putting into a lightweight backpacking or
7 days.
Yeah, or man in a can, giant canisters of protein powder. So there are some shall we say, I don't know if clandestine would be the right word, but small, portable, little known things that can give you a step up when it comes to essentially anabolism, and especially anabolism while you are extremely physically active. Some a little bit fringe, some not so fringe. So, for example, there's one in particular. Why don't we start with the fringe right away? There's one that I am writing an article on right now, and it's called a selective androgen receptor modulator, also a SARMs. Rachel, I know you're a complete nerd when it comes to SARMs.
I know everything about SARMs. Just learned what the acronym meant.
All the time. Yeah. So these selective androgen receptor modulators actually contain what are called androgens. And androgens are a special kind of hormone that act as a ligand. So I'm going to add this to your vernacular. What a ligand is all that is a molecule that's linked to another molecule, a ligand, L-I-G-A-N-D. And in this case, androgens connect to cellular androgen receptors. Now, what that can do is it can replicate the effects of androgens, which in the human body would cause things like muscle growth and anabolism, etc. But selective androgen receptor modulators are able to do this without causing a lot of the side effects that, say, steroids can cause. So they can be taken orally, so you don't need to inject them. You don't get a lot of the deleterious side effects of taking steroids. And the idea here is that they're non-toxic. They don't cause liver damage. A lot of times when you're taking testosterone or you're taking steroids, you can get some bone loss. And they've looked into SARMs and bone loss, and they don't cause that. A lot of times in men who are using testosterone replacement therapy or who are using steroids, they get prostate problems. They get, I'll use the highly scientific term, ball shrinkage. And you don't get that when you use a selective androgen receptor modulator. It doesn't interfere with what's called your hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. This means that when you take testosterone, injectable testosterone, or testosterone creams, you, via a negative feedback loop, shut down your body's own endogenous production of testosterone. And should you ever stop that steroid or that testosterone replacement, you feel like crap for months afterwards. You can't get it up. You have no libido. You have low motivation, low ability to put on muscle, low endogenous testosterone production. you don't get that when you use one of these selective androgen receptor modulators. You also don't get conversion of testosterone into estrogens or into something that can make you go bald, which is dihydrotestosterone or DHT. And you'll see a lot of folks in the athletic or the bodybuilding industry using SARMs to prevent muscle loss and to assist with lean muscle development. And you'll even see these used for things like, you know, faster injury recovery and increased power and better joint healing abilities, et cetera. So
are there any cons to these?
Cons to SARMs? You can, if you overdo it in women, you can get a little bit of a development of male characteristics.
Wow, right, so that's kind of a big deal, Ben. Right?
Big eyebrows, big chin. So you'd want to be careful. In men who overdo SARMs, there is some risk for some of the same things we would get with a huge production of DHT, which would be like acne and baldness and even a little bit of gynecomastia. But this would be high doses taken for a long period. Okay, so a typical SARMs cycle would be running it for just 4 weeks, for example, like taking a SARMs orally. An example dosage would be like 10 milliliters for about 4 weeks. Probably, and the one that I'm writing an article about right now that I've really been doing a lot of research on is one called LGD4033. That's the one that's most used for things like building muscle and increasing libido and simultaneously reducing body fat percentage without taking hormones or without taking steroids. For all of you listening in, especially those of you who don't want to risk extreme public embarrassment because you compete in a sport that involves urine testing, you can't use these if you compete in a World Anti-Doping Association sanctioned sport, even though about a tenth of the world's athletic population uses SARMs. They've approximated. So a ton of pro athletes use SARMs, even though they're not supposed to. However, if you're just hiking the Appalachian Trail and you want to maintain skeletal muscle mass without deterioration of, for example, type 2 muscle fibers would be the big one that this is going to assist with development of SARMs. You know, taking something like LGD4033, a little bottle of it out there on the trail, and taking one dropper full, which is about 10 milliliters under the tongue on a daily basis, could help out quite a bit with maintenance of lean muscle during endurance exercise or long exercise sessions.
So that's number one.
So that's one, LGD4033, SARMs. Another one might as well just stay fringe. BPC-157, yes. That is an injectable peptide. This one is legal based on World Anti-Doping Association and USADA regulations, and it's simply a sequence of amino acids. So you've heard of perhaps branched-chain amino acids or essential amino acids. This is like that on steroids. They've done a huge number of studies and shown everything from enhanced repair of tendons and muscle and intestines and teeth and bone. I've got a big article on BPC-157, and I mean, you can take an insulin syringe and just spray it orally into your mouth to enhance repair of gut damage. You can take any specific muscle group that is injured and poke it into the little bit of skin near to that injury site and inject it and rub it in or massage it in and get extremely enhanced muscle repair. I'm talking about like 10 times faster. I've done it with a hamstring injury, for example, and completely banished it within a few days. The other thing that you can do is you can use it to maintain muscle by either using it's systemic, right? So you can use it orally, you can inject it anywhere, and it's going to have full body systemic effects.
Wow.
And so you can literally use this while out on a trail and just inject it anywhere or take it orally, and it will help to maintain muscle mass or even to build muscle mass. So, it's somewhat fragile. You'd have to be careful with it getting jarred around after you have to reconstitute it. So it comes as a powder and you mix water, and I've got all the instructions on I'll link. If you go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/357, I'll put a link to the article that I wrote about it, in the show notes. But, basically it's similar to like a SARMs, you know, an extremely small bottle that is extremely potent, or so, as they'd say in Aladdin, phenomenal cosmic power.
You need a bit of living space. One question. If I took it orally for an injury in my wrist, it would still have the same impact as injecting it into my wrist or no?
Not the same. Less, okay. Less, but still an impact.
Okay.
Yeah. If you just don't like to shove needles into body parts.
Right. So, yeah. So we have Psalms and BPC 157. What's next?
So another one that I'd recommend would be something that we touched on earlier, and that would be the use of exogenous ketones. Because by utilizing ketones rather than your own muscle glycogen or rather than glucose, you can spare muscle glucose or spare blood glucose, spare muscle glycogen, and keep yourself from having to break down your own storage fuel as energy. And the cool thing about ketones is that they're very potent and can be carried in light amounts, because that's what we're talking about, things that are light, portable, easy to carry, but that can maintain muscle mass similar to a ribeye steak or a protein shake. So there are a lot of different types of ketones out there. But because the consumption of what are called medium-chain triglycerides, or MCTs, actually enhance the production of ketone bodies by the liver, I am a fan of a specific form of exogenous ketones. Again, if you don't want to spend the $3,000 on that ketone ester developed by DARPA that I mentioned earlier, but you want something a little bit more palatable for the pocketbook. A pretty good one would be, for example, there's a company called Keto OS. And that is ketone mineral salts that have been blended with a high fiber, medium chain triglyceride formation. So you get the benefits of both exogenous ketones along with medium chain triglycerides. The small packet, relatively light, you would reconstitute it in water. And the ingredients are just MCT powder, beta hydroxybutyrate, which is the ketone, and then stevia. And you can choose, they've got one that's caffeine free. And one that they call Charge that has caffeine in it, but that's it. And the other thing that you should know is that ketones act as a natural diuretic, so you may need to make sure that you increase your electrolyte and your water intake when you start using something like this. But that would certainly be something that if I were on a long trail hike, I would definitely throw into the mix, would be this Keto OS blend of powdered MCTs with exogenous ketones in the form of beta hydroxybutyrate.
Yes. Good fuel. So,
yes. And we're increasing everybody's vocabulary with all sorts of big words like LGD 4033 and SARMs and beta hydroxybutyrate. Next, we would go for something very nutrient dense. So I talked about how BPC 157 is an anabolic amino acid. Well, another thing that has a lot of anabolic amino acids in it, including 18 of the 20 amino acids and all 8 of the essential amino acids that your body can't produce, making it a complete protein, is spirulina. Mm-hmm. Spirulina has, you know, it's got more beta carotene than carrots. It's got more iron than spinach. It's got more antioxidants than blueberries. It's got more chlorophyll than any dark leafy green shake. And it has a nutritional profile that's very, very similar to breast milk, which is close to a perfect food. You can get spirulina in like chewable tablet form. You can get it in powder form. But considering the dense amount of amino acids in it, and this is especially useful for vegans or vegetarians who can't use an animal-based amino acid or, you know, or a steak or, you know, chicken or things like that that are very anabolic, this is lightweight, it's easy to carry, and it acts like an oral full-spectrum amino acid with the vegan twist. And plus, it turns your mouth green. So
you have definite added benefit.
You can be that person on the Appalachian Trail with green stains all around your mouth as though you've just eaten, I don't know, what green animal would be out in the forest that one would be chasing through the forest and eating, like a zombie.
A frog.
Yes, you're like a frog-eating Appalachian Trail hiker. So spirulina would be another one. And of course, along with spirulina, for the similar amino acid effect, just essential amino acids. So they've done a host of studies on stopping muscle breakdown with the use of branched chain amino acids. The problem with branched chain amino acids is that while they can keep muscular catabolism from occurring during long-term endurance exercise, they do not result in the same anabolic effect as essential amino acids, because there's only 3 of them in branched chain amino acids, whereas an essential amino acid blend is going to have 8 to 9 different amino acids in it. And branched chain amino acids can also spike blood sugar levels and cause some other issues that I'm not a fan of. And finally, they don't lead to the staving off of central nervous system fatigue the same as essential amino acids do, because essential amino acids will compete for tryptophan in the brain and keep tryptophan, our sleepy, you know, turkey Thanksgiving molecule, from crossing the blood-brain barrier, from interacting with the cellular receptors for tryptophan. And so ultimately, an essential amino acids blend, and I'll put a link in the show notes to the one that I like called Nature Aminos, would be another one to include. So where are we at so far with what we have listed?
So we got spirulina, Nature Aminos. There's one more that I think you want to talk about.
SARMs, BPC, colostrum.
Yes.
Colostrum. Yeah. Colostrum is huge. I'm a big fan of that. It's such a potent, so what it is what you'd find in breast milk, in the fluid that comes out right before the breast milk comes out, in like a goat, cow, mom, whatever. I'm a big fan of a goat-based colostrum, because a goat-based colostrum, unless you have a pregnant woman producing breast milk who you can carry out there with you on the Appalachian Trail, it's very biocompatible with the human body, meaning that it's a small protein that gets absorbed very well compared to like a cow-based colostrum. And colostrum has a huge number of growth factors in it that can do everything from heal the lining of a leaky gut, which is what it does in an infant, to cause actual growth of muscle tissue in adult humans. And you can simply take this, for example, in the morning when you get up, you know, 4 to 6 capsules of colostrum, and it has some very potent immune boosting effects. The only caution I'd give you if you're hiking with it is it can't be heated. You need to be careful when you heat it. It's enhanced with pairing with probiotics. So if you take it at the same time that you take probiotics, all the better. But know that whether you're using that or probiotics, you just need to be careful that it doesn't get heated up too much. However, not only is it a big performance enhancing aid, but colostrum has a very, very potent anabolic effect. So if you're just trying to get swole as muscular as possible, you would be on colostrum, spirulina, aminos, some kind of exogenous ketone, some BPC 157. And then if you aren't competing in a World Anti-Doping Association or USADA sanctioned sport, something like SARMs, like LGD 4033, and you will get big. As a matter of fact, Rachel, I don't think I've mentioned this on the show before, but aside from the SARMs agent, I'm actually using everything that I just talked about while lifting heavy.
Hmm. Well, there you go.
Because I got cast on a TV show that I got to put on muscle for.
What TV show?
The Broken Skull Challenge.
Oh, wow.
It's on CMT, on Country Music Television, but it involves heavy. Go watch it if you're listening in. Just do a search for Broken Skull Challenge, or actually we'll put a link in the show notes. The defending champion right now, speak of the devil, we talked about him earlier, is Hunter McIntyre, my partner in crime over at Obstacle Dominator. But you have to fight, you have to lift heavy objects,
you're gonna fight Hunter.
I don't know if Hunter will be on the show when I'm on it, but you have to be a meathead. So I am trying to put on some muscle to become a meathead so that in a few weeks I'll be able to compete when I head down to film the Broken Skull Challenge in LA. So
that's going to be funny. I can't wait to see that. So that is basically how Alexi can have his cake and eat it too.
Boom.
Is it like, is it out there in the world that people should drink breast milk?
People?
Like why do we drink and eat colostrum and we don't drink and eat like our own breast milk?
So my personal hypothesis on that, because I don't know the exact answer, is that A, we don't drink the breast milk of our own species because we have access to things like goats and cows and camels and I don't know whatever else can be milked as the line goes from the movie with Ben Stiller and Robert De Niro. I'm a cat. Could you milk me, Fokker? You can milk it if it has nipples, right? So we've got access to the breast milk of other animals, and we're smart enough to access that because, let's face it, mothers and mothers' breast milk, that is something that would best be reserved for the growing baby population of our species. And if all of us adults start drinking breast milk of our own species, we would probably risk babies not having enough.
Right. That's, I see,
my personal hypothesis.
If there was a way for babies to have enough, though, it would be better, obviously, to drink our own, because it's made for humans, not for animals.
Yeah. And if you look at things that have nutrient dense profiles similar to breast milk, right, like spirulina or liver or eggs or any of these things high in fat soluble vitamins, we certainly have access to things that will be a little bit of a parallel to breast milk in nature that we can take in. But I wouldn't be surprised if someone at some point comes up with a way to do, like, you know, breast milk from a lab where it's all the things in breast milk, colostrum and growth factors and probiotics and everything else. And, you know, maybe it comes in a breast shaped bottle that you buy from the grocery store.
And then Freud is like rolling over in his grave.
And Freud is freaking rolling over in his grave. Yep.
Hey, Rachel and Ben, thanks so much for an awesome podcast. I'm learning so much. It's so awesome. Please keep it up. Today I have a question about COMT genetic mutation, of which I have. And I know that that means that you can have a hard time breaking down catecholamines. And I definitely have major insomnia issues. If I'm out late at night, I just cannot wind down. And I just feel like I have all this adrenaline and cortisol going on. And it's really difficult for me to ever fall asleep if I'm out too late or if I'm just too amped up in the evening. So I was just wondering if you had any advice on this for those of us with the COMT mutation, and if there's anything that we can do to help break down those catecholamines that would help us, you know, get more into our parasympathetic nervous system. So thanks so much. Look forward to your answer.
So Rachel, just to F with you, what's this question about?
This question is about the warrior versus the warrior gene.
The what versus the what?
The warrior, I got to say it like an American, warrior versus what? No, they still sound the same.
I love how an Australian cannot say warrior versus warrior. It's just not, you're not able to do it. Your tongue doesn't move that way.
It doesn't, no.
Yeah, this is really, really, really interesting. It's this idea. I won't geek out too much on the COMT gene, but what it comes down to is that we have this specific gene called the COMT. It stands for catechol-O-methyltransferase, COMT. And all that is, put in simple terms, it's an enzyme, and it degrades things like dopamine and epinephrine and norepinephrine. And depending on which version of that gene that you carry, you're either going to break down things like dopamine and epinephrine and norepinephrine quickly, or they're going to hang around for a long period of time in your system. And that's going to influence your behavior and your personality. So we have this worrier profile. The worrier has lower amounts of COMT. And what does that mean? It means they break down their dopamine less quickly and they have higher amounts of dopamine. When you have higher amounts of dopamine, you get more pleasure out of life, but you also get, interestingly, a lot of people don't realize this, more misery out of life. You have bigger highs and also bigger lows when you're a worrier. So what are the positives of that? Well, you get more pleasure out of life, like I mentioned, and they've done studies where they've shown that people who have what's called the AA gene for COMT have twice the amount of positive emotions towards a pleasant event than the people who have the double G version of that gene. You tend to be more creative because dopamine in the prefrontal cortex of your brain promotes cognitive stability and makes you more resistant to distractions. So worriers tend to be able to focus on and be more creative. You tend to have a higher IQ with the higher dopamine levels. You tend to have better working memory, and they've actually done tests. They've done one test called an NBAC test, where people with this low amount of COMT, high amount of dopamine, these warrior genes, they have better reading comprehension and better working memory, and even more plasticity of the brain going into old age. A warrior also, when they're not under stress, and this is important, a warrior does better with attention and processing of information under stress, but a worrier has better cognitive function when they're not under stress. So in a stress-free scenario, a worrier does quite well, aka computer programming versus, you know, operating a radio in a battlefield. Mm-hmm. So a few other things, you tend to have better fine motor skills, and these are all things that they've tested. And you tend to be able to focus more when you realize that you've made an error. And people who have the warrior gene, they even have a better ability to be able to aim a weapon, interestingly, like a gun or a bow. What are the bad things? Well, you don't handle stress as well as a warrior does because of that high amount of dopamine. So it can work for you and against you. You tend to be more impulsive. You tend to have a higher risk for depression and anxiety, and you tend to be more neurotic. They've even shown that there are some other issues in terms of like increased cocaine dependence and nicotine dependence and things that you would expect when you have a higher dopaminergic response to certain chemicals. And then they've also found that there are certain medical conditions associated with having this worrier gene, primarily high amounts of like ADHD and ADD, high amounts of like fibromyalgia, which is like, you know, ghost muscle pains and sensitivity to heat and pressure and things like that. So if you have this particular low CMT, high dopamine, there are some things that you can do. If you have this worrier gene, which would be what Kathy has, this hard time breaking down catecholamines, insomnia issues, etc. Some of the things that you can do. First of all, you can ensure that you have adequate amounts of B vitamins, like B6 and B12 and folate and what's called betaine. And the reason for that is because high amounts of these B vitamins support formation of something called adenosylmethionine. And that prevents, or at least partially inhibits, this COMT activity and can assist with the dopamine breakdown a little bit more readily. So that's one thing, is getting a really good vitamin B complex, even just a multivitamin. You know, like I like the Thorne multivitamin because it has a lot of what's called methyl tetrahydrofolate in it, which is like a very bioabsorbable form of vitamin B. Another one that seems to help with this is magnesium. High amounts of magnesium citrate, which is another cofactor for some of the enzymes that can help to break down dopamine when dopamine is high. That would be another one to make sure that you include in your diet would be adequate magnesium.
Is that also in the Thorne multi?
No, that would be something you could take, like a natural calm magnesium, or you could even use topical magnesium and rub it on your tummy. That's a perfect place to absorb topical magnesium. Interestingly, is the stomach, high amount of blood vessels. And you know, that's where I'll put topical magnesium a lot of the time. Be very careful with alcohol consumption, because alcohol can cause a rapid release of dopamine, especially in limbic areas of the brain, that can not only increase your vulnerability to alcohol dependence, but can also increase the incidence of things like insomnia, et cetera. Hmm. You would want to avoid stimulants. Any type of stimulant, including caffeine, honestly, can cause a high amount of this dopaminergic activity. And so you may want to consider, you know, using non-caffeinated beverages, you know, white teas, things like that, as opposed to coffee.
What if you have the COMT mutation and you're a fast caffeine metabolizer? Does that even itself out?
No, I'd still be careful. You're still going to have, I like the way you're thinking, but antioxidants. So antioxidants are going to be important because those prevent the oxidation of all this dopamine that you have hanging around. And that can be pro-carcinogenic in high amounts, oxidized dopamine. So what you would want to do, for example, like I mentioned, that Thorne multivitamin, that's got actually some really good antioxidants in it, like vitamin C and vitamin E and some of the things that can help out with this high amount of dopamine and prevent the actual oxidation of that dopamine. What are a few other little things? There's something called diindolmethane. You're going to find that in cruciferous vegetables like broccoli, etc. You can also purchase it as a supplement called DIM. And the reason for that is because if you have high estrogens, estrogens can actually inhibit COMT and cause more of this dopamine to be hanging around in the bloodstream. So preventing excess estrogens, both from, like, you know, your personal care products, you know, phytoestrogens from plastics, things like that, but also considering use of this DIM or this diindolmethane, or, you know, things like broccoli and cauliflower and things high in diindolmethane can also help out quite a bit. And I'll list some of these recommendations in the show notes for you. There's also, of course, the warrior gene, which is everything that I just said, the opposite of that, mm-hmm. right? Like really good under high stress scenarios, low amounts of dopamine, you know, lower amounts of pleasure out of life. You know, when you have this warrior gene, you know, in many cases, you know, better performance under pressure, better performance under stress, you know, but worse executive function, sometimes worse fine motor skills. This is the classic you know, meathead fighter, no offense, Navy SEAL, you know, type of approach. And, mm-hmm. and these people just don't produce as much dopamine. And so there are issues that you can, or things that you can take into consideration for this. The biggest would be you'd want to get dopamine into your system. There's a lot of different ways to do that. But if you happen to test, and you can just use, you know, 23andMe testing to get this test done and figure it out. For the warrior genes, probably the best thing you can do is there's a supplement called Brain Food. And this is just a dopamine precursor. It's made by Axon Labs. I've had the folks from them or from Axon Labs on the podcast before. And I'll link to it in the show notes. But it's just a dopamine precursor that can help you. It's kind of cool. If you take dopamine precursors prior to any pleasurable activity, like sex or eating or anything, it just kind of like psilocybin mushrooms, for example, it just makes everything a little brighter, more colorful.
What about if you have tastier. The comp mutation and you take a dopamine precursor? How then? Is that like quadruple pleasurable?
Your head will explode. I don't think that would help out with Kathy's insomnia. But
don't do that, Kathy. It's a bad idea.
You can try. So, and I'll put a link to the 23andMe genetic testing if you want to test this out, as well as some of the other recommendations that I went into. All of those over in the show notes at bengreenfieldfitness.com/357. So hopefully that helps you out. And you can also grab everything over there from the olive oil that I recommend to some of those things for maintaining muscle during exercise to this new ketone drink article from the Department of Defense, the Casper mattresses, the calendar, and much more. But of course, we would be doing everyone a great disservice if we didn't give something away, right, Rachel?
Correct.
Yes.
So, do it. Yeah.
So this is the part of the show where we take the top iTunes review of the week and we give you something cool. We're going to send you a BPA-free water bottle. We're going to send you a tech t-shirt that makes your muscles look great, whether or not you're breastfeeding. And we're going to send you, that made no sense, but I just said it anyways. We're also going to send you a hat, a toque, a beanie, a Ben Greenfield Fitness beanie. And all you need to do is this. If you hear your review read on the show, just email gear@greenfieldfitnesssystems.com. That's gear@greenfieldfitnesssystems.com. And if your 5-star unique review gets read, you will get that pack. Just be sure that when you email said address, you include your t-shirt size and your mailing address. So that being said, we've got a review left by Bob RVL. And Bob RVL says, you want to take this one away, Rachel?
Yes, it's called Great Podcasts and it's 5 stars. I am a big fan of Dave Asprey. And when I was introduced to Ben's podcast, the first thing I thought was, this is the athletic Dave Asprey. I can relate to Ben because I'm a CrossFit coach and competitor. I'm always looking for ways to hack my performance and nutrition. Thanks for the great info and entertainment. I like the woo-woo stuff you air.
Dave Asprey, for those of you who don't know, he's the Bulletproof guy.
He's the guy
who invented Bulletproof coffee, the Bulletproof exec. Not necessarily known for being an uber athlete per se, but I would in no way want this to indicate that Dave is a spaz because I have seen him do headstands on vibration platforms before at conferences, and he's not an athletic tard. But
he's not going to run a Spartan and then a Hurricane Heat this weekend, is he?
I never know.
Maybe he
could be there. So
maybe we'll meet him in Portland.
Anyways, though, I like Dave Asprey. He's a friend of mine. I didn't want you to read this review because I don't like Dave, but I think it's a good review. And I will take it. I will now go by the title, The Athletic Dave Asprey. That's what you
can call me. Woo-woo stuff.
Yes, who likes woo-woo stuff. So that being said, you can access all the show notes at bengreenfieldfitness.com/357. You can watch Rachel and I doing a Finnish sauna or whatever else we decide to do this weekend by going to bengreenfieldfitness.com/Snapchat. And you can also win stuff over there. Plenty more coming down the pipeline. A fantastic interview this weekend, I believe, with the, speaking of woo-woo, man himself, Dennis McKenna, about LSD and psilocybin and ayahuasca and all sorts of interesting things. So that should be interesting. And in the meantime, thank you for listening. And Rachel.
Yes, Ben.
Enjoy the rest of your day, pirate patch or not.
You've been listening to the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast. Go to bengreenfieldfitness.com for even more cutting-edge fitness and performance advice.